underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Rachel Kadish is the author of the novels From a Sealed Room and Tolstoy Lied, A Love Story. Her latest novel is The Weight of Ink. Set in London of the 1660s and of the early 21st century, The Weight of Ink is the interwoven tale of two women of remarkable intellect. Esther Velasquez, an immigrant from Amsterdam who is permitted to scribe for a blind rabbi just before the plague hits the city, and Helen Watt, an ailing historian with a love of Jewish history. Again, the new novel is The Weight of Ink, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Rachel Kadish to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
What brought you to this subject and ultimately these characters, these two women?
I tend to write when something is bothering me and I'm not exactly sure why or what to think about it. And for me, the way I figure things out is to start writing and see where the writing goes. And some years ago, one of the things that was rattling around in my head was a question that was actually first posed by a writer named Olive Schreiner, but is much more famous for Virginia Woolf voicing the same question. And the question is this: what if William Shakespeare had had an equally talented sister? What would have been the fate of that woman? And Virginia Woolf's answer is very succinct. What would that woman's fate have been? She died without writing a word. And I think that is obviously the most likely fate for a woman of capacious intellect in an age that certainly didn't make room for that. But the question was just bouncing around in my head. And of course, it's not just a historical question. It's a question that's still relevant because we all know people, we all know women whose ambitions or lives or dreams have been blocked because they didn't fit with the norms of their time or their culture. So I started asking myself, what would it have taken for a woman of that kind of intellect in that time not to die without writing a word? And what if she were further hampered by being poor or being a member of a religious minority? And I became very interested in writing about this community of Spanish Inquisition refugees and Portuguese Inquisition refugees who found some safe haven in Amsterdam, and then some of them later moved to London. And the more I researched this community, the more they fascinated me and really moved me. And so I wanted to write something set in that population.
Obviously, it's a novel, but how much in your exploration do you know of what that fate and what would have happened? And how much have you imagined and surmised?
Right. Well, I was kind of a crazy stickler about research because I've had that experience of reading historical fiction. And then if I happen to know that one detail is out of place, it throws me out of the whole illusion of fiction. So I was very, very careful that the entire story had to be plausible down to the details of what people ate, what they wore, their social interactions. And so I researched very closely the histories of that particular community, the physical details of life. But then there's this other question of could this woman's life have existed? Because in the story, not to give too much away, but Esther Velasquez manages to really launch a grand deception so that she can have a life of the mind that was denied to most women in that time. And I actually do think it could have happened. I don't think that the fact that we don't have evidence for a lot of women doing that kind of thing at the time means that they weren't doing it. Because if you think about it, anyone who did it had to disguise themselves. Any woman who was trying to write pretty much needed to do it under a man's name. So if she succeeded, how would we know? So I feel that the story is plausible, and I worked very hard to make it so.
The fact that the book takes place in London, in England, do you feel that is the bridge to Shakespeare's world? That's something that you wanted to keep it there from the very early germ of the idea?
I think so. I mean, I mostly was interested in this tiny community. I happen to be a big Anglophile, and, you know, from being an English major, I always want to go there in my imagination.
Sure.
But I was really fascinated by, when I say I was fascinated by this refugee community, part of what really moved me about them was that what felt so familiar. I grew up around Holocaust refugees. My mother's family, my grandparents were survivors. My mother was born on the run. And when I started reading about this community of Inquisition refugees 350 years ago, there was so much that was familiar about their fear, their passions, their desire to reestablish their identity, their nervousness. And so I wanted to follow that community, and I became really interested in this tiny community in London that was sort of semi-hidden and outed against its will. And so I wanted to follow that community there and write about what it might have been like to live in that sort of half-uncertain community. And that also led me into the same time period as Shakespeare.
I thought it was very interesting that you are quoted as saying that when it comes to your grandparents, that as a kid you thought that an accent was something that you acquired with age.
Yes. Well, when I was a kid, everybody over the age of 40, which seemed very old at the time, had an accent. So I thought, well, that was just, you know, when I get older, I'd see what accent I got. And, you know, I guess when we get over 40, we all turn Polish. But then, of course, the joke is that, well, you know, I mean, it's true. We all have accents. And realizing how much we all are shaped by where we're from. And just because my accent is an American accent doesn't mean that my history isn't shaping me.
You talked a moment ago about being a stickler for research. So with the facts, I assume that with each fact that you find opens up 30 more questions, right?
Yes, yes. It's, I mean, imagine I'm writing a scene. It should be a simple scene. It's at a couple of people at a dinner table in 1665, right? But what are the utensils on the table? And what are the table manners? And when they look out the window, what's the glass of the window like? Because they couldn't make those big plates of glass. It was those little wavery panes of glass with a million panes. And then what does the lever on the window look like? And what's growing in the garden outside? And pretty soon you're down the rabbit hole and you've been on the internet for an hour researching things. But it's also fun. And also people, I think, sometimes assume that you do all the research first and then you write. But in fact, to me, that would be like swimming a mile by doing all the breathing first and then swimming the mile. It just wouldn't make sense.
That's a great analogy.
You know, I research enough to write the scene, and then I hit a point where I can't write what's next because I don't know what their lives were like, and then I go do the research. So it's back and forth.
I love that you use the term that it was fun, because I think that's so much for those of us who are in some sort of creative pursuit, mm-hmm. that you may think that is a roadblock or something, mm-hmm. that hampers you in some way. But when you say, oh, you know, you get to go to a library or to some website that will bring you down this path, that can be just a blast.
Yeah. Oh, I had such fun, and people were willing to talk to me. I was so grateful. Like, I would call up the some archivist or a paper conservator, and I'd say, can I come to your lab? And at first, you know, the response would be, well, we could give you 45 minutes. That's all we have. And then I get there, and they talked to me for 3 hours, which was glorious, because I think people don't usually come to the lab and say, tell me about the paper fibers, you know, but I would find out about these kinds of ink that over hundreds of years eat their way through paper. Actually, the letters dissolve themselves through the paper, and you end up with a piece of paper that's like a lattice with the words burned through it. Just gorgeous stuff. And it was so much fun researching it. And then also, writing is hard, so it's always more fun to research the next fact than it is to actually have to figure out, you know, the next sentence.
Get back to that point.
Yeah, exactly. Can I research something else? Yeah.
Rachel Kadish is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Weight of Ink. I am interested in the research because when you go down this path and suddenly you say, oh, well, where does one find a Judeo-Portuguese expert?
Mm-hmm.
Does that pose a problem, or is that easy?
The internet is a wonderful thing, and I kept stumbling across the irony of the fact that I'm writing about the 17th century, and there is no way I could have written this book without, you know, consulting Mr. Google every 3 seconds.
Right.
But, you know, so I would, if I needed to know how to say something in Judeo-Portuguese, a specific dialect, I would email the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in New York, or I would look online for the archives in the Amsterdam Portuguese Jewish community. So there were so many people who were just so generous.
So when you look at these two women and the characterization of them during this time, what I found fascinating is not only their lives, but also how they intersect. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious as to how you allowed that to develop through the course of writing the novel.
I did not plan this book out in advance. I think a sensible person probably would have written an outline and proceeded that way. But I guess I'm not a sensible person that way, because for me, I can't figure out what the plot of a story ought to be until I figure out who the characters are. Because if you put two different people under pressure, they'll react in two different ways. We all react differently. So first I have to write a while and mess around and figure out who my characters are, and I have to figure out what pressures they're under. And for me, character plus pressure equals plot. That's how you find out what your story is. And if I tried to figure out my plot in advance, it just wouldn't make sense. So what I did, I mean, I wrote this book pretty much in the order in which you see it. And it's so the opening chapter is when these documents are discovered in contemporary London, and Helen Watt is called in to see them. And they affect her deeply, and she begins to notice some things about them that don't initially make sense. And then you go back to the 17th century, and you see Esther Velasquez, and how she comes to scribe for this blind rabbi and have access to books and learning that she wouldn't otherwise have. And, you know, her realization that the rabbi is in the room and is blind and can't see what she's reading or writing. And we go back and forth. And I really made things up as I went along. It was an act of improvisation, because I would write in one time period until I didn't know what the answer was. And then I'd switch to the other time period. And I felt like Helen Watt, the historian, was being moved and affected and caused to reflect on her own life and her own choices and sometimes mistakes every time she learned more of Esther's story. So there was a real interaction between these two characters, even though they're separated by more than 300 years. And I really put it together as I went along, and then I had to go back and edit. But I didn't know where I was going till halfway through.
That idea of not knowing where you were going, were you always sure that there would be the back and forth in that 300-year disparity?
Yes, I felt like there was some connection there. And for me, that's very intuitive, because I feel like I've always felt, whether it's because of growing up among refugees or I don't know what, but I've always felt that history is very alive and is acting in our lives right now. And so for Helen, someone who loves history, to discover a trove of documents left by an anonymous woman 350 years earlier, that was going to affect her life in some way. And I just needed to be patient and keep reading and find out how. And I think because I didn't know what was going to happen, and it was so improvisational, I was certainly on the edge of my seat the whole time I was writing.
You touched on this, but I want to ask you specifically, how then do you approach a language that is appropriate for both periods of time?
Right. That was tough. It took me a long time to figure that out. The contemporary chapters are just in a contemporary
Sure.
English. But for the 17th century chapters, I mean, I couldn't be anachronistic. I didn't want to use anything that would have thrown you out of the time period. But I couldn't also write the way they actually spoke in the 1600s, because, you know, there's a reason people don't pick up Samuel Pepys's diary and read it for fun, even though it's totally salacious stuff. But that sentence structure is very hard for us. So what I did in the end was I used a more modern sentence structure, but I had a rule for myself, which is that as far as I could, I would make sure that I didn't use any word in those chapters, even for a description of a boat. I didn't use any word that wasn't in use in the language at the time. So when Esther chaperones Mary around London, I can't use the word chaperone, because that's a 1700s word. So she had to be her companion or her duenna. And I hoped that by doing that, I would convey the flavor of an old language without making the book hard to read.
Again, with the understanding that you didn't plan this out, the idea of the geography lesson that you give us within the course of the novel is really fascinating.
Thank you.
And did that come rather naturally because of that immigrant experience and saying, oh, well, this doesn't have to be a person. This person can be from here.
Right. I think the experience I had growing up made me not afraid of history and made me not think of it as something dry. I mean, history was the reason that my grandparents would sometimes switch over to Polish and tell secrets and laugh or fall silent. It was the stuff you wanted to know. It was what made people who they were, for better and for worse. So I think I wasn't afraid of it. It was an enormous amount of fun for me. I had to learn so much in order to write the book. But then I also felt that if I was going to ask the reader to learn that much, there better be a big payoff, and I better figure out a way to tell a good story.
Is it true that it's 10 years?
Yes, even a little bit more, closer to 12 years, partly because there was so much research, partly because I had two young kids. So there was a lot of stopping and starting.
It's fascinating because when I got my copy of the book in the mail from the publicist, there is a postcard in it that says, "I like big books and I cannot lie," which is funny in and of itself. And I have had this over my desk for the last several weeks. I think it's important to note, though, I love big books. I really do love big books. I love to just become immersed and just dive in. I'm not a person who is scared off by 1,200 pages. It just looks good. I have a long-term commitment. I like that.
Right.
But for the writer, what is that like?
I also love big books on the reading side, and I love that feeling of, okay, we're sitting down for a 7-course meal now.
Right.
For me, I love that feeling of immersing in another world. I mean, I miss these characters in this world now that I've finished writing. But in the interim, while I was writing this book, I paused and I wrote a novella because that's all that story needed to be. But this was a big story, and it needed this kind of space to grow in. So you just have to be insanely patient. And then there's an E.L. Doctorow quote I love, and I won't get it exactly right, but he basically said, "We write novels the way we drive a car at night. You're driving from point A to point B. And at any given moment, all you can see is the little patch of road that's lit up by your headlights. But patch by patch, we get there. So you don't have to know where you're going." So I didn't know what a big book this was going to turn out to be. But I knew it felt big, and I just needed to be patient and see where it went.
This is a bit of an outside question, but there is also the commercial pressure. So is everyone else in your publishing life patient when you say, okay, this is going to take me a while?
You know what? I have a really, really wonderful agent and a really wonderful editor. And when writer friends found out how long the manuscript, a while I wouldn't say how long the manuscript was because I was just embarrassed. I was just, it's long. It's really long. And then I cut it down. But there are books out there that are this long. I'm a big fan of A.S. Byatt's Possession, and it's a similar length. So
yeah.
So they were pretty kind to me once they read the book, and this is a story that needs some space, and I think they saw that.
The novel is The Weight of Ink, and it is by Rachel Kadish. For you, how different is this from your previous work?
I've dabbled in little bits of history before, but this was just diving straight in, so this was totally different. And I think that's part of what made it a lot of fun. I don't like to write the same book over and over. Maybe I like that feeling of sheer terror, but I like to jump into something really different.
How much terror was there at the beginning of taking on a historical fiction?
I think it reminds me a little bit of parenthood, where you don't know what you're getting into, and that's a good thing.
Sure.
So I didn't know how much I was taking on, and the further I went into it, I would say, oh my God, well, I need to figure out the language for the 17th century now, and I need to figure out how the characters thought about daylight, which is different from how we think about it, because we have electric light. So for them, when it gets dark, you go to sleep, unless you're really wealthy and you can afford the candles. Or how they thought about death or disease or time was really different. So it, as I got in, I thought, wow, this is a really big thing I took on. But by then I was in, and I was having fun.
Was it written in a linear fashion?
I wrote it pretty much in the order it's in. I mean, I wrote it in chronological order for each section. And about halfway through the book, I realized where it needed to go. And I realized that, you know, when you spend that much time with characters, there are so many rewards for the writer toward the end, where you suddenly realize, oh, my God, this character has this thing about them that I never realized. But here they are. And they step forward at the end of the book. So it was, it just kept gaining momentum as I went.
When you send it out into the world, and especially when you have an idea of what you want to discuss, what do you hope people will discuss and think about as they close the book?
Oh, wow. You know, I think this is probably the moment where the writer has to step back from, you know, being a control freak about every comma and say, you know, it's in your hands now.
Sure.
I think I would love to see people discussing it in terms of the resonances of history in our lives. I would love to see people discussing it in terms of what it means to be a refugee, or Jewish history, or certainly women's history. You know, this question, because the book reaches back in time to ask this question of, you know, what does it take for a woman not to be defeated when everything around her is telling her to sit down and mind her manners? And certainly that's a relevant question today, too. So there's so many, there's a lot of philosophy in the book that I had to work very, very hard to learn, because I do not have a philosophy brain, but my character does. So I had to follow her there. So I did a little interview with the American Philosophical Association. And I love that people who know about that topic would discuss the book.
I was just going to ask you about the philosophical aspect of the book, because it's fascinating. It brings you in many directions that perhaps you weren't thinking about going, and maybe at times even get you thinking about things other than what is on the page at that very moment, which for me I found delightful.
I really love doing it, and it scared me, because I realized, you know, if you're going to write well and not write the same book over and over as a writer, you have to be willing to write about characters who are different from yourself. Now, I've never studied philosophy. That subject intimidates me a lot. But my character, I wanted to write about a woman with that kind of Shakespearean mind, but her area of strength is in philosophy. She wants to ask those questions that Spinoza was asking in the same time period and in the same community. And in order to write her story, I needed to learn about that world. And at first, I felt like I was, maybe this is too old a reference, but that I was the Milli Vanilli of metaphysics, that I was just lip-syncing metaphysics, yeah. And I didn't really know what I was doing, and I had to do a lot of reading to learn how to write what questions she would have been asking and how she would ask them in a time when it was so dangerous to ask these questions that, you know, people were literally ripped limb from limb for discussing atheism.
The other aspect, of course, is the Jewish history. Did that come more naturally?
I knew a fair bit about the Jewish history of the time, in the Ashkenazic Jewish history and the Sabbatean crisis. There was this false messiah, the biggest false messiah crisis in Jewish history, Shabtai Tzvi, or Sabbatai Zvi, depending. There are a lot of different iterations of his name. Mm-hmm. Had thousands and thousands of followers across Europe, and everybody believed that 1666 was going to be the big messianic year, and people were selling all their belongings and getting ready to follow him to the promised land, and then that all fell apart. And I knew a bit about that history, but I didn't know very much about the Inquisition refugees at all, the Sephardic Jewish community. So I had to do a lot of reading, which was delightful.
You mentioned a moment ago about the idea of stepping back and then putting it out into the world. And you also mentioned that you're missing these characters. Mm-hmm. So what now?
I have an idea for a new novel. I am afraid to say anything about it because I don't want to jinx it. And I have some short stories and essays that I've been working on.
So well, you mentioned novella, so you're still writing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's for me, it really is like breathing. I can't make sense of what I think of a lot of things until I sit down and get some quiet time and try to write.
But when you finish a project, especially one of this length, there has to be a certain relief, too. Like, oh,
definitely.
There you go.
Definitely.
I
did the very best I could with this book. I'm sure if I opened it up 6 months from now and looked at it, I would say, oh, my God, I need to rewrite that sentence.
Yeah,
but the good thing is I can't.
Don't do that.
It again, right? On to the next thing.
Well, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful novel. And Toni Morrison says, a gifted writer, astonishingly adept at nuance, narration, and the politics of passion. You have to love seeing that come across your desk.
Yes,
yeah, that's
I feel
pretty beautiful.
Incredibly, incredibly lucky.
The name of the novel is The Weight of Ink. And Rachel Kadish, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us. A delight.
Thank you so much for having me.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.